Welcome back to Copper Country Today. I'm your host, Rick Allen, and we're going to be dedicating this segment to talking about disaster preparedness in general, but certainly in light of the recent events in Nepal with the earthquake, just such a tragedy that happened there, and to give us perspective of what's going on there right now as they respond to just the devastating earthquake and following aftershocks and some of the other things that are happening in that area. I am joined by Dr. Wayne Pennington. He is the Dean of the College of Engineering at Michigan Tech. Dr. Pennington, welcome to Copper Country Today.
Thank you very much. I'm glad to be here.
There's been a story almost every day now talking about the response to the devastation that's over there. And here we are, we're recording this on a Tuesday morning, and just a few hours ago there's a report of another major aftershock in the area. So this is an ongoing situation. I asked you to come here to let's first talk about what's kind of going on. I know you haven't been there personally to Nepal since the earthquake, but just sort of give us an idea of what's been happening since this earthquake occurred.
Well, the first thing that happened was the immediate rescue teams came in, partly to assess the damage. Of course, it turns out most of the rescues that happen of individual people happens through their neighbors. Having a strong neighborhood structure is extremely important. But then the rescue teams come in and try to do what they can. In this case, it was very difficult because the roads were impassable. The houses that came down essentially crumbled around people and onto them. So it was very difficult to rescue anybody from that sort of environment. Nonetheless, the rescue teams, search and rescue, and then recovery in the end, move into the various communities trying to help as best they can. In most cases, they were just simply too late because of the difficulty of getting there. The next step, though, is to help people rebuild in a way that can avoid further disasters. Right now, they're still just trying to establish camps for people to live in safely. A fear, of course, is the spread of diseases like cholera when the wastewater and drinking water mix, which is likely to happen in temporary situations like this. The ongoing aftershocks are, of course, a terror for people. Structures that were weakened during the main earthquake are quite likely to be more likely to fall down during the aftershocks. Aftershocks are a perfectly natural part of the process, but they're just terrifying to the population, no question about it.
Now, the original earthquake was measured at 7.8. Give us an idea in comparison to, say, some of the more famous earthquakes. How does that compare in strength?
Well, it's because it happened in a populated area, it's right up there with among the most powerful ones that most people would have experienced during an earthquake. Some bigger ones occur in remote areas occasionally, but say the Indonesian one that resulted in the tsunami, this was nowhere near as large as that. But let's compare it, say, with the Haiti earthquake. This was much larger than the Haiti earthquake. The magnitude scale is a logarithmic one, so each unit larger, like from a 7 to an 8, is 10 times larger in the amplitude of measurements on seismograms, or 38 times larger in energy released. So from a 7.0 in Haiti to a 7.8 in this case, that's a big change, almost a factor of 10 difference.
What amazes me when I read accounts of the earthquake from people who were there of how quickly an earthquake strikes. I mean, I don't know if it's just my mind being poisoned from television, which you picture the earth shaking for a long period of time, but it's a matter of seconds that this thing changes. There is no time to react.
That's right. So I experienced a magnitude 7.7 in southern Mexico. It was the Petatlan earthquake in 1979. And I was in the village of Petatlan at the time. For many of these earthquakes, you can feel a little bit of shaking at the start. And what that is the fastest seismic waves that travel through the earth might reach you and wake you up. In this case, in Mexico, it woke me up. But the largest shaking comes almost immediately after the smallest event, the compressional waves that come first, and you have no time to react. In that case, it was a matter of at the most 3 or 4 seconds because we were right on top of the earthquake. And when the large shaking comes, there's nothing you can do about it. Some people say, when there's an earthquake, run for the doors. That's not necessarily good advice, by the way. You're better off taking shelter under something that might support a collapsed roof. In this room, for example, you and I would be fighting for the space right where you are on the floor in order to have the desk hold up the roof should it collapse on us. That's a lot better than running out the door. But in a magnitude 7 earthquake or larger, you can't run out the door. You can't move at all. You're lucky if you could remain standing. Chances are you'll be knocked to the floor, and there's not much you can do about it then, except ride the shaking out.
Now, what's your biggest danger during an earthquake? We see a lot about mudslides and landslides, avalanches, but that's not what causes most of the fatalities.
That's right. Most of the fatalities are from the structures collapsing around the people. In a lot of the mountain villages in the Himalayas, the buildings are constructed from local rock, not even carved rock, just brought up out of the riverbed, stacked up, mud and so on, put in between them, so that they're essentially like rounded bricks of a large shape, large size, piled up, and then a heavy roof on top of that. And the roof might even be used for thrashing grain. There might even be livestock that could be used on the roof. So the roof is extremely strong and heavy, but when the walls collapse, that roof just comes right down on top of the people inside. So most deaths caused from collapse of buildings.
Now, after the earthquake has struck and the recovery process is underway with trying to get survivors, hopefully, the bodies certainly of those who perished, what are the other problems that the people in the villages are dealing with at that point?
Well, the main thing is shelter. Of course, they don't want to go back into their damaged structures if they did survive the earthquake, if the structures did survive, because they're weakened and they're terrified. The people are terrified of the earthquakes, of the aftershocks, which are just simply additional earthquakes. Sometimes people think aftershocks are different. Statistically, they're different, but they're still honest-to-goodness earthquakes. So finding warmth and comfort is the most important thing immediately. Food and water is of some importance as well, but it's usually not quite as important as the aid agencies make it sound, because it's easy for them to find ways to distribute food and water, and it's very photogenic, easy to have film crews set up as they're distributing it. But most communities have a bit of resilience in that. The next important thing, though, is with the temporary structures that people put up, usually tents or tarp cities, there's a lack of hygiene. And so the spread of disease can be a very real problem. And trying to make sure that that does not happen, that it doesn't even start, is one of the bigger problems. An interesting thing that Nepal will face come about 2 or 3 months from now is, how do they disband those tent cities? How do they get people to move out of them? Because now the crisis is over, or at that time the crisis will be over, and people should be starting to resume some sort of normal lives. If the tent cities have become nice enough, if the food distribution is efficient enough, if the water supply is good enough, what's making them want to leave? So that's a very difficult step to take. You could imagine the headlines in the newspaper, the aid agencies force people to leave refugee camps. It just doesn't play well. But to get the economy going again and to get the people in a sustainable livelihood, they cannot keep them in the refugee-type camps.
Did you see a similar result with the after effects of the earthquake in Haiti?
Yes, exactly. Hmm. And many people have used the Haiti example as one of demonstrating how difficult that is and how aid should not be provided in ways that feel so good but turn out to be so wrong in the long run.
This earthquake has hit home, especially at Michigan Tech, where there's a lot of students from Nepal who, you know, they've banded together to try to raise money. There's some other efforts going on. I know the Houghton Rotary were putting together something. So on this topic, I mean, what's the best thing that people should focus their energies on?
Well, certainly providing money to the reputable aid agencies is one of the best things to do. Sometimes people will do food drives and things, and that's less efficient because the food has to be transported someplace, and it may be of a sort of food that isn't culturally acceptable. In fact, after Hurricane Katrina, some other countries provided the U.S. with food, and some of that food was, say, baby baby food made from horse meat. That just wasn't going to happen in this country. So it's hard to second guess what it is that's useful for us, for a population. And the aid agencies do the best job of that on the ground, in the location where it's needed, with cash.
I was also reading that was along with the earthquake, with the landslides, that some of these villages were positioned in a way that their entire villages were buried in landslides.
Yes, certainly in a rugged mountainous area like this, that can be a big problem. And from the news reports that I've read, that probably was a problem there. The villages can be buried by landslides, and then a second problem can occur later. The landslide may dam up a valley, so it dams up the stream that runs through the valley. Then a lake develops behind that, and the lake eventually overtops this temporary dam that was built by the landslide, and it floods the downstream area suddenly after that. And that's a problem that they're probably looking into right now with aerial reconnaissance.
Now, is this part of the world, does it hit frequently with earthquakes?
In general, yes. The Himalayas are an area where the Indian subcontinent crashes into the Asian continent, and it's continuing to move. That's why the Himalayas are so tall, why the Tibetan Plateau is there. And as it continues to come together, earthquakes occur with some regularity. Now, in Nepal, best guess from recounting history over the past few centuries is that roughly on the order of every 75 or 80 years, there's another earthquake. Now, it's not that regular. That would be an average. Might be 50 years, might be 120 years. Mm-hmm. But the last earthquake of this size, magnitude 8, was in 1934 in roughly the same area.
So when you visited Nepal and you were discussing about being prepared for something like this, was the fact that one had not hit in close to 80 years, does that lull people into a sense of security?
Unfortunately, it lulls, say, politicians into a sense of security, because they easily feel that, well, they'll be through with their terms, or at least the next election, before anything bad happens, so they don't need to concentrate on that themselves. The relief workers, on the other hand, just continually get more nervous, knowing that it's going to happen at some point. And the longer that it takes in between these events, the chances are that it'll be a bigger event. If we had three good-sized magnitude 6.5 or 7 earthquakes in those 80 years, that would have relieved the stress that was then relieved in this magnitude 7.8.
Other than a sense of sort of an impending doom, is there any other warning sign that, you know, like something that was going to happen?
No, there isn't really. Every now and then there are studies of animal behavior or peculiar foreshock behavior, small earthquakes that seem to be coalescing, migrating from one place to another. But that's, we can never figure that out ahead of time. Each case seems to be a special, odd, new case. So there is no short-term prediction.
All right. Well, while you were there at the conference in Nepal in 2010, what were your observations and your message to the people there?
Well, the observations were that the civilian and military organizations needed to be coordinated for the relief operations, but that was the point of the conference, and they were doing a good job of that. So that was regional cooperation, various governments in the area working together through both civilian and military systems. On a personal level, a few of us went and toured parts of Kathmandu and nearby just to see what the construction looked like. And our observations there was horrifying. The building practices were extremely non-safe for earthquakes. They might build a three-story building without earthquake-proof design to start with, and then a few years later add a fourth story, and a few years later add a fifth story. This sort of thing is just guaranteed to fall down during a big earthquake. It's like an inverted pendulum, so when it starts swinging, it just swings more.
And undoubtedly, these practices of building and additional building and not following any kind of structured code, all that had to have led to the more than 8,000 deaths right now. That's a death toll for that earthquake.
That's right. Now, some people have made something about the fact that The prediction was we would have about 40,000 dead during the next large earthquake in Kathmandu area. That was based on the 1934 magnitude 8 earthquake and the percentage of population that died then. Given the growth in population, a similar earthquake and similar percentage would have resulted in 40,000 or so dead. I think that two things made the difference. One is that the earthquake wasn't quite as big. Remembering that it's a logarithmic scale, there's a big difference between a 7.8 and an 8. But also, I think that we see the effects of some of the building practices having improved. Some of the word did get through. There are a few organizations that are extremely active in Nepal. The most well-known is Geohazards International, working with NSET, the National Society for Earthquake Technology, in Kathmandu, to educate builders and to try to encourage adherence to building codes so that buildings get built with earthquake-resistant design. So I think most engineered structures, we might say schools, hospitals, and so on, have been built to pretty good standards in recent years. And the effort was to get smaller builders, the small apartment buildings, individual homeowners, and so on, to build to better standards. And I think that we see some effect of that happening.
We've seen in history a city perhaps devastated by fire that destroys much of the buildings. When it's rebuilt, they're a lot more aware of fire dangers. Do you foresee them sort of taking this and learning from it and applying these stricter codes as they begin to rebuild?
It's curious. All the sociologists who study this sort of thing say that right now is the time to do exactly that, to try to get adherence to building codes and so on. It turns out in many developing countries, it's just extremely difficult. The politicians are facing so many challenges during the reconstruction phase that they tend to slight the need for enforced building codes. Time will tell how it goes. One thing that I think is extremely important, a lot of the engineered structures are built through assistance from foreign governments, different non-government organizations and so on. And those organizations really need to be extremely strict that their contractors and subcontractors stick to safe practices. As soon as it gets out of hand, where somebody's not watching over it, the likelihood of poor practice becomes great.
It wasn't more than a couple of weeks ago that Michigan had an earthquake down in Kalamazoo, certainly not to anywhere near the extent of what they experienced over in Nepal, but it shows that these things could hit closer to home.
Yes, they can. And in fact, there was a small event, you could call it an earthquake, near Menominee a few years ago as well, that only a few people felt that right in the immediate neighborhood. So small earthquakes could occur just about anywhere in the world. Michigan is one of the least active places in the world, though.
Okay, and I wasn't even aware of it until somebody brought it up to me, but I guess there's a Keweenaw Fault. I mean, it's historical, goes back a long ways, but I mean, there's potential there for even us to not be as isolated and protected as we believe we are.
Well, the Keweenaw Fault was active 1 billion, with a B, years ago.
So we're due.
We're overdue. I wouldn't look at it that way. Back then, it played a very important part in the tectonics of the globe, actually, and is part of the system that resulted in the copper deposits here and so on, and the Portage Lake volcanics that we're sitting on right here in the studio. But as far as anybody can tell, it really has not been active since then. The glacial deposits on top of it make it a little bit easier to test has it been active in the last 10,000 years than, say, some other faults might be to test that, and it has not been active.
Well, it's good news. We'll keep looking out for the next earthquake, but disasters come in other forms. What are some things that people that are in the listening area of this program should be more aware of and prepared for, and how do they do that?
Well, if you're on the waterfront, of course, there's a possibility of high water during big storms and so on. But really the biggest problem here would be if something in the winter shuts down the electric power. So many things that we use dependent on electric power. So that's something that we all have to have in the back of our mind. How do we keep our pipes from freezing? How do we keep ourselves from freezing? But the disaster agencies have other things in mind as well, things that you and I might not be planning for, and there's no need for us to plan for. But what if a truck containing some sort of toxic material turns over on the road right out front here and shuts off access to the bridge? On the other side of the bridge are the hospitals. Well, suddenly we've got a hazardous material being dispersed and difficulty of getting emergency relief back and forth. Those are the sorts of things that the local county-level disaster people prepare for. They have to be prepared for them at all times because you never know when it's going to happen. And when it does happen, we're glad they've got those systems in place.
So do individuals and families take in any steps to be prepared just in case they, you know, are cut off and have to be ready in case of a kind of a disaster?
I think the plans that people have for, say, tornadoes or other storms are good plans, or fires, of course, fire in a house. How to get in touch with each other, that is a very difficult thing. The earthquake I was in Mexico, it was 3 days before I was able to call home and tell my wife that I was still all right. And in a disaster area where there may be thousands of people trying to reconnect with their loved ones or find out what happened to them, if there was some sort of plan, you know, call your Uncle Joe in Massachusetts, leave messages with him. Or if there's a fire, we gather down the street in front of Susie's house, something like that. Those make a big difference. And all of the studies really have shown that the resilient communities, the ones that survive disasters, are the ones that have the strongest social network, because in the immediate aftermath, they know how to look out for each other. If a building collapses, for example, the neighbors are the ones to know, well, you know, old Joe, at this time of the evening, he's usually in the front room reading the newspaper. That's where we'll look for him, where the front room used to be. The relief agency comes by a few hours later. They don't know that Joe used to be reading the newspaper in the front room and that's where to look for him. They could look for him anywhere.
Well, now that the earthquake has happened, hopefully the aftershocks are over or going to be over soon in Nepal. They're going to be picking up the pieces. Are you going to play any role in sort of getting them prepared as they move forward, or is that part already been done?
That part's been done. I keep paying attention to what it is that's going on, and occasionally I'm in communication with some of the people involved. But I think that the best part I can do is to help keep people informed, much like we're doing right now. I'm not playing a role in what's going on in Nepal. The best people to do that are on the ground in Nepal, or they have sent the best people from their agencies on the ground, and they're doing a good job as best they can right now. By the way, on the aftershocks, they'll keep continuing for years.
Oh, really?
Yeah. Statistically, they'll get fewer and farther between, but every now and then, there'll be another big one. There will be several more of magnitude 6.5 probably in the next 3 years in that area. And if you happen to be right over that 6.5 when it occurs, that's a big earthquake.
Well, given its location, it is a popular place for world tourists because of its proximity to the Himalayas. Is it an area that should be avoided for a little while?
Well, certainly right now. Anybody who goes there is in the way of the relief operations. And in fact, even the people that have been on the mountains as tourists, some of them are absorbing relief operations when they shouldn't be. They should be walking out. Maybe they're taking helicopters out. Those helicopters should be used for the people that are hurt. Of course, if the tourists are hurt, they're part of the victim population as well. But nobody should be going into the area without a good reason and without good plans for a while.
You mentioned earlier, if you're going to try to help out with the relief effort, to make sure that your resources are going to a reputable relief organization. Are there any good examples of that, since people are trying to raise money?
Certainly things like the International Red Cross is always held up as one of the best examples. Some of the faith-based organizations are also very good. Catholic Relief Services is a good example of that. For building construction, Geohazards International is one that I mentioned, and another one called buildchange.org. It's a newer organization, but extremely effective at training local masons to build individual homes extremely well throughout places where disasters occur. The part that the energy that seems most, that people seem to get the most value internally for, but actually has the smallest impact, are the small organizations that put together packages to send over, or small groups of people. Those people, if they aren't already experts in this operation, they're going to just simply be in the way and absorb relief resources instead of adding to them.
Dr. Wayne Pennington, thanks so much for coming on the show and, you know, giving us perspective on this terrible tragedy.
Well, thank you very much. It's been my pleasure.
Copper Country Today will be right back.